Marines, United States against Pain.
May it please the court.
Mr. Gay.
Thank you. May it please the court, Your Honors. My client was sentenced to over 17 and a half years in prison. Of that amount, over 14 years resulted directly from the district judge's determination of loss at the loss and sentencing hearings. In light of that fact, this appeal presents two simple and straightforward propositions. First, that the district judge's loss and sentencing determinations invoke the Supreme Court's decisions in Apprendi and McMillan. Second, each and every defendant has a right to be sentenced based on reliable information. Necessarily inherent in that standard is that the district judge makes an independent assessment of the reliability of that information. And furthermore, Your Honors, that assessment cannot be based solely on the fact that somebody appeared before the district judge and told the district judge that that information was reliable. Now, with respect to the first point, Your Honors, the government has asserted that Mr. Payne waived his Apprendi argument at the district court level. However, this court has time and again, as indicated by the cases cited in our brief, stated that where a Apprendi argument is not presented at the district court level, it will review for plain error. Secondly, this court has stated that it has not yet seen a case where extreme upward sentencing departures standing alone invoke Apprendi. Therefore, Mr. Payne could not have intentionally relinquished a known right. The government also makes much of the fact that Mr. Payne's sentence that he ultimately received did not exceed the statutory maximum. However, as it is clear from our briefs, that is not our argument. Our argument is simply that the proceedings at the loss and sentencing hearings invoked the rationale of Apprendi and McMillan, and also, as stated by this court, invoked the rationale of the Seventh Circuit in stating that there may be certain instances where extreme upward sentencing enhancements invoke the standards of Apprendi and McMillan.
So I understand that his calculation of the sentencing range was 168 to 210 months, right?
That was the sentencing range that Mr. Payne stipulated to. And what he ultimately received, I believe, was 211 months.
1 month over.
1 month over. That's correct, Your Honor.
Are we talking about a month?
I've advised my client of the risk he takes on appeal. And at the same time, I would say that while Mr. Payne provided in his plea agreement for a sentencing range, of course, and this court will correct me if I'm wrong, the district judge was not bound by that stipulation. And secondly, the district judge did not engage in any sort of progressive sentencing. The district judge did not state, well, I find a loss of between 10 and 20 million, therefore I'm going to give you, let's say, 170 months. The district judge said, I find a loss of over 20 million, I'm going to increase your sentence by 170 months. And it is our contention that that substantial enhancement invokes Apprendi and McMillan, Your Honor.
Well, increasing it 170 months, there isn't a base 170 months down, is there?
There was. That was stipulated to, Your Honor.
Well, I thought that you said between 10 and 20 million.
What Mr. Payne stipulated to in his plea agreement was a loss of between 10 to 20 million.
And that's what is the...
However,
the range for that?
The range was, as stated by His Honor, that it was 168 to 210 months.
So where does this 170 come in?
The 170 comes in, Your Honor, if you do not assume that Mr. Payne walked into that loss hearing already subject to a sentencing range of 168 to 210 months. If you assume that Mr. Payne walked into the sentencing hearing with a clean slate, which is what I believe we have to assume based on the record before us, Then you arrive at a sentencing enhancement of 170 months based on what the parties provided for in their plea agreement, and the only determination that the district judge had to make at the loss and sentencing hearings was loss. And that loss determination directly resulted in a sentencing enhancement of 170 months. Now, with regard to our second point, Your Honor, that is that the district judge must make an independent assessment of the reliability of the evidence. We believe that this court's precedent aptly supports that proposition. First, in U.S. versus Beeler, this court noted specifically that the sentencing guidelines, and there's no dispute about that, this requires sufficient indicia of reliability in the information presented at the loss and sentencing hearings. It is our contention that necessarily implicit in that statement by this court and in the sentencing guidelines is the standard that a judge must make an independent assessment of that reliability. In fact, in Beeler, this court criticized the district judge's, quote, conclusory findings at the sentencing phase. In the First Circuit case of U.S. versus Tavano, the First Circuit stated that the sentencing judge must exercise independent judgment in sentencing. As authority for that proposition, the First Circuit cited this court's decision in U.S. versus Goins. And in U.S. versus Goins, the court stated district judges must, quote, resist the urge to accept summarily the quantity alleged by the government. Furthermore, in U.S. versus Galbraith, this court stated that where inconsistent evidence is presented at the sentencing phase, that by itself may be deemed as unreliable for purposes of the sentencing guidelines. I would submit, Your Honors, that the corollary of that proposition, which is advanced here, is that sheer hearsay testimony that is not subject to any testing or independent verification by the district judge is also, or should be, deemed as unreliable before this court.
In this type of case, what kind of evidence do you think is necessary for the government to put on to convince the
Well, in this case, I think that the government's witness, Ms. Gavin, stated exactly the type of evidence that's necessary to put on. She stated that in her review, she went through computer data, she went through the documents that were culled from the investment shop through which Mr. Payne operated. She relied on bank records. She relied on surveys. She relied on any information that you would expect an accountant, a forensic accountant, to rely upon in giving her testimony. However, none of that evidence was brought to the district court at the day of the loss hearing.
Why did it have to be? The rules of evidence say that an expert may rely on such underlying data as are normal in the profession.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Of course, we know the rules of evidence don't even apply, so if an accountant could do this kind of thing at a trial, and in fact this is done at a trial all the time in tax prosecutions, mm-hmm. What's wrong with doing it at sentencing?
The problem here is, as you stated, Your Honor, the sentencing guidelines do not apply at the sentencing phase.
Yeah, the rules of evidence at sentencing are even looser than the rules at trial. But the kind of evidence that was offered here is the kind of evidence often offered at trial on the merits and admitted.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, Ms. Gavin was never qualified as an expert. Now, I will acknowledge that she didn't have to be, but our contention is, given the fact
was,
that...
Was her ability to perform an expert analysis challenged?
It wasn't challenged. However, no. We would state, Your Honor...
Explain why people didn't go through the Rule 702 drill.
Well, I'm not stating that we had to go through a Rule 702 drill, but what we are stating is that the sentencing guidelines put the burden squarely on the district judge, and I would submit on the government as an officer of the court, to ensure that that minimum protection and an independent assessment can be made by the district judge. I would reserve the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Warden.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is James Warden. I represent the government here, as I did before the district court. as counsel for the appellant stated, there are two issues before this court, one dealing with what burden of proof applies in this loss computation, and secondly, somewhat whether the government actually met that burden or whether it was better stated, whether it was clearly erroneous that the court found what it did with regard to that proof. I think it's important to start because I think this issue was mischaracterized in terms of its significance by counsel this morning, because in the plea agreement, which of course is part of the record, after negotiation of course, the appellant stipulated that the loss was not less than $10 million, and it states explicitly, let me refer to paragraph 10C of the plea agreement, it says explicitly that the parties dispute the amount of loss, hence there's a notice with respect to this. The defendant contends that the loss is more than $10 million, but less than $20 million, and hence he will argue that there are 15 levels added for loss. And the government contends that the loss is greater than $20 million and will advocate then that 16 levels are argued. So in a different way, as Judge Kaney said it, there's really only an argument about one level in these guidelines. This isn't the 170 months that's been created here. With respect to the burden of proof, the case law is very clear, the guidelines are very clear, that the general rule is it's a preponderance of the evidence. This is not an upward departure case that would even raise the issue raised by counsel this morning about a significant upward departure may be akin to Apprendi. This is a sentence within the guidelines. This did not change the maximum statutory penalty. And so this court has said repeatedly, Apprendi is not even invoked in this case. So there's no logical basis to argue that the standard was anything other than preponderance. The defendant, now the appellant, did waive that at the district court because, as cited in my brief, on the record, the judge even asks him, do you agree with the government that the standard is preponderance? He affirmatively answers that question. That is a waiver. But again, if this court finds he hasn't waived it, it's whether or not it's clearly erroneous, and it's not. Now, with respect to the proof here, the record completely contradicts the argument made by Payne on this appeal about the attention that was paid by the court to the argument. The first thing that Judge Easterbrook said is that this is done routinely in the manner that's done here, and of course in the record is the fact that the defendant had this information, that the documents that now they say have to be brought into court were provided, of course, in discovery in this case, and there's mention of that not in the loss hearing specifically, but elsewhere in the record. But more importantly, the witness, Ms. Gaffin, explained the basis of her computation, explained the records that she relied upon. So this independent analysis is whether or not Ms. Gaffin's testimony makes sense, whether or not it's reliable. And she explained the various sources of information that she used, not only the computer database of the appellant's false company, the actual hard records of the investors, and very significantly, the fact that she made contact with each of the individual investors to verify her computation. So this was an excruciating effort on her part to determine loss accurately.
What that was cross-examination was?
There was cross-examination, Your Honor, and most specifically, it wasn't about that issue, but it was really about whether or not certain specific investments that were part of the Ponzi scheme should be counted for the loss, and whether or not some non-fraudulent business monies were included. And she answered those in a way that was consistent with the district court's determination of what the loss was. So she was subject to cross-examination, and importantly, there was no evidence. Of course, the defense is not required to put any evidence on at sentencing, but if he wants to contest this, he can. The defendant offered no contrary evidence in any way. The district judge explained in detail, and it's in the record and cited in the government's brief, why he found what he did. He didn't do it in a conclusory fashion, just saying, well, the government's met its burden, thank you very much. He went through the things that I've said today and in my brief as to why the evidence provided by Ms. Gaffin was complete, why it was internally consistent, why it then supported his determination that the loss was in excess of $20 million and that the government had met that burden. Unless this court has further questions, I will end my argument and rely further on my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Warden.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Argay?
Very, very brief, Your Honor. First, and the court will obviously conduct its own review of the record, I personally could not find anything in the record to indicate that the defendant was supplied with any of the documents relied upon by Ms. Gavin. Secondly, as Your Honor indicated, or implied, the cross-examination in this case was plainly insufficient. Now, this is not an ineffective assistance of counsel appeal. However, what we would contend is, in light of an insufficient cross-examination, the burden would fall directly on the district judge to independently ask questions and to independently scrutinize the reliability of the evidence presented at the loss and sentencing hearings. Counsel for the government office...
We have an adversarial system. What questions to ask depends on lawyers. When have we said that district judges have to take over from lawyers and figure out what the basis of an expert's opinion is?
I believe that this court, in its decisions in Beeler and in the other cases I mentioned in my presentation, Your Honor, stand for the proposition that in light of the looser evidentiary standards of sentencing, that the district judge may not base his sentencing determination on, quote, and I believe this comes from U.S. versus Duarte, nebulous eyeballing. And I believe time and again this court has made statements which imply, if not explicitly state, that the district that burden falls on the district judge. This court has never stated that a sentencing determination is reliable because a defendant has conducted a sufficient cross-examination. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gay, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case. You have our thanks. The case is taken under advisement.